Our guest this morning, BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, says that perhaps more than any other individual, Akio Kan is personally responsible for the spread of the nuclear bomb over the past few decades. In this hour of our program, our guest, Gordon Carrera, will talk about Akio Kan and about his recently published book, which is titled Shopping for Bombs. The subtitle is Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the Akio Kan Network. The book is published by the Oxford University Press and tells the story of this engineer, this Pakistani engineer, of his rise and fall and of his role in selling nuclear secrets. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him here on the program. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. Gordon Carrera has been a security correspondent for the BBC since 2004. In that role, he covers counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and international security issues for BBC TV, radio, and online. Before that, he was a foreign affairs reporter on the Today program. That's the BBC's Today program. It's one of their leading news shows. He's also been a State Department correspondent based in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. affairs analyst for BBC News. He's reported from across this country, also Asia, Africa, the Middle East, including covering Iraq before and after the 2003 war. He's also reported on Guantanamo Bay, on the September 11th attacks, and also the Madrid and London bombings. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people listening is that people just try to be brief in their questions and comments so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But callers are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Carrera, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
No problem.
We certainly appreciate it. Just how important, I know that in I've read you say this very thing that I mentioned in the introduction about how just how important Akio Kan has been in spreading nuclear bomb technology. Just how important?
I think it's a murky story, but if you look at the countries which have got hold of the bomb in the last few decades, if you look at Pakistan's program, you look at what Iran is trying to do, you look at the North Korean program, you look at what Libya tried to do, you can see Akio Kan's hand in all of those stories, in all of those countries in trying to develop the bomb. And so it really is a global story. I mean, it starts in Pakistan, but it's really about the spread of nuclear weapons and of nuclear technology and nuclear know-how and the degree to which the genie may have been let out of the bottle by Akio Kan.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but it mentioned at this point, probably it's worth mentioning that after it was revealed what he had done, the president of Pakistan, General Musharraf, pardoned him. So Mr. Kan is now under house arrest. He's apparently living at his house. And there's a lot. The thinking is that there may be more to this than we know, and certainly the CIA and perhaps other intelligence agencies or the IAEA would like to talk with Akio Kan and find out if there is more to this story, but the government of Pakistan won't let that happen.
No doubt that a lot of people want to talk to him and find out more, and that's because there are still a lot of mysteries about what exactly he did and what technology he gave to whom. There's a lot of concern that maybe he had more customers, maybe he gave some of this technology to other countries who we don't know about, and there is even some evidence that he may have done that, and people would like to know, well, you know, who might those countries be who might be secretly developing nuclear programs? Also, for instance, Iran. We know he gave a lot of nuclear assistance to Iran, invaluable in their program. But exactly how much, that's very important to know, because it would give us some idea how far advanced the Iranian nuclear program is and whether it or not it is geared towards weapons, which is something the Iranians say it isn't, but a lot of people suspect that it is. Akio Kan knows the answers almost certainly to some of those things, and that's why people want to talk to him.
Yeah, let's talk about his story. He was trained as an engineer. He was educated in Pakistan, and then he went to Europe to do graduate work. He gets a PhD, and then he goes to work for a company there, and that was what puts him into the position of having access to very important technical information that is necessary to then produce the material that either you could use it in a nuclear reactor to generate power, or you could use it to make a nuclear weapon.
Exactly. It's he was basically in the early 70s given a job at a company called Urenco, which was really at the absolute cutting edge of technology in uranium enrichment. And Europe was trying to be the leaders in this process of uranium enrichment. And as you said, you can either enrich the material to use as power, or you can enrich it further to make it highly enriched, in which case you can use it for a bomb. And you do this in centrifuge machines, and the same centrifuge can make it highly enriched for a bomb or for power. And basically, AQ Khan got a job in which he was, because of sloppy security, given access to these most advanced European designs on centrifuges, this very secret technology he was given access to. And he basically copied it, learnt about it, learnt how to make it. More importantly, he learnt who was making it, which companies, which suppliers made each tiny part, so that eventually when he left Urenco, he could go replicate that process, get in touch with the suppliers and build Pakistan's own bomb.
Mm-hmm. The we should establish a little bit of the context here that there has been long been tense, difficult relations between Pakistan and India, pretty much ever since partition that it's been that way. And certainly India and Pakistan have fought a couple of wars. Mm. Kashmir has been and continues to be flashpoint and a point of conflict. And the concern that a lot of people have had about the proliferation issue is that now that we know that both sides are capable of producing nuclear weapons, that a conflict could escalate to that point and the weapons might be used. The concern of the Pakistanis became particularly acute at the point where India demonstrated the capability to design, construct, test nuclear weapons. Once Pakistan decided that we had a nuclear arms race going in here, and if India had the bomb, Pakistan had to have the bomb, how did AQ Khan get involved in this project to produce a Pakistani bomb? And did he initiate this? Was he recruited? How did he get involved in this?
Well, it's really interesting because he didn't come to Europe as an atomic spy, if you like. He just came as a student to learn. But it was while he was here in the 70s, as he got that job at Urenco, that things were happening back home in Pakistan, which were so important, because in December 1971, Pakistan was defeated by India, which was a real shock to Pakistan. The country was broken in two. Bangladesh became independent. So that was a shock to the country, which really affected AQ Khan. Secondly, in 1974, India conducted a nuclear test, or what it called a peaceful nuclear test. It said it wasn't a bomb, it was just conducting a nuclear explosion. But that also created shockwaves through Pakistan. And that seems to have been the key event which led to AQ Khan, who was then doing this job at Urenco, writing to Pakistan's prime minister and saying to him, offering his services, effectively saying, I have access to the most secret technology. I can help you build a bomb. Do you want my help? And of course, he got a positive response. He went to Pakistan to meet officials, but was told, don't come back here yet. Stay in Europe, stay working in this facility, and gather all the information you can, and then come back to us and help us.
And it was pretty clear that that's what he did. When he did come back and apparently apply this technology that he had gained by working in this company, even though initially he denied that, people asked him, how is it that Pakistan was able to do this and do it so fast? He made it sound as if, well, there was enough information that was in the public domain, as if you could go on the internet or you could go to the library and learn how to do this. He initially said, well, this was something that indigenous Pakistani engineering talent, perseverance, work, you know, we built this all by ourselves. But apparently it's very clear, if you look at the technology, particularly the design of these centrifuges, that is indeed what happened. He simply stole it. He took that information, which is supposed to be controlled so not everybody can have it, and brought it back to Pakistan with him. And that really was the foundation of the Pakistani nuclear program.
Absolutely. The designs are identical. All the designs that Khan used, that he spread to other countries, all of them originate from that material he got from Europe in the 70s. He went back to Pakistan there and he used that material. He talked to the suppliers who'd supplied the Europeans and said, I will give you an extra commission, extra money, if you start supplying me. And he toured around Europe with colleagues, getting all the right parts. And a lot of companies were willing to supply him, even though it was pretty obvious what the Pakistanis were doing, partly because they never realized the Pakistanis would be capable of it. They never thought they would be. But he built up this network of businesses, of suppliers, of front companies to build Pakistan's nuclear program, which by the 80s was up and running pretty effectively.
You mentioned the fact that he was had worked for this company, Urenco. This was set up by several European governments, and the purpose of the company was to produce fuel for nuclear reactors, but that, of course, it also had this possibility of producing bomb-grade material, if that's what you wanted to do. That technology could. What sort of controls are there on the centrifuge technology to make sure, or to do what one can, that technology is controlled and not anyone can have access to it?
Well, I think the key thing is that actually centrifuges are incredibly complex pieces of machinery. They are incredibly difficult to manufacture because what they do is they spin at amazingly high speeds. They spin a corrosive gas at amazingly high speeds to enrich it, to separate out the different parts. This is really advanced technology and really advanced engineering, and it takes years and years and decades to perfect it, as, for instance, the Iranians are finding now. That it is not something that anyone can do. And so a lot of the challenges are understanding how to spin it so fast, how to get the right parts, the right materials which could withstand such speeds and the stresses, and also work with the corrosive gas. So it is a very complex piece of technology, and the parts you need are quite specific as a result. So once it became clear that other countries might try and build centrifuges, in the 70s there were the beginnings of export control laws put into place by countries saying, we won't sell these parts for centrifuges. We won't allow them to be sold. But one of the problems that Pakistan and AQ Khan got around was that they started to look for the parts that allowed them to build it themselves. So rather than buying whole centrifuges or even the major parts, they would buy the parts that could make parts. They would buy subcomponents. They would do everything they could to get around these export control laws and frankly, play on the greed of a lot of businessmen who were keen to supply them and keen to make the larger amounts of money that Pakistan were offering.
Mm. Well, that gets to this basic question that if we just ask about what Khan did to gain the technical expertise, bring it back to Pakistan, then get the hardware to put it together to produce the centrifuges, to produce the fuel, to produce the bombs, what of that, if any of that, that he did was illegal?
Well, that's a really interesting question because legality doesn't particularly come into it in this context. I mean, particularly because Pakistan never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's never signed up to it, neither did India, nor has Israel. And so, actually, technically, Pakistan was breaking no international law by building a nuclear weapon. I mean, it was, and AQ Khan was given freedom by the Pakistani state to do what he wanted. So, you know, in terms of legality, that really wasn't the problem. A lot of countries wanted to stop AQ Khan, and by the late 70s, there was an awareness that he was causing trouble, and the U.S. and others tried to clamp down on him. But effectively, already by then, it was too late because he'd accumulated a lot of the knowledge, a lot of the contacts, and a lot of the key technology to get on with it during the 80s and build Pakistan's own program. Mm.
Yeah, there's more to the story, and we'll continue to talk about this, but I guess at this point, one important bottom line here to the story, even if all we were talking about was the Pakistani nuclear effort, the important bottom line is that the structures we have in place to limit the spread of the technology and weapons, we have to say they don't work very well.
I think that's right, and I think they still don't work very well. They didn't then. They didn't now. I mean, there have been some success stories in preventing countries getting the technology, and a lot of these export control laws and other things, they can slow down countries, but it's very hard, actually, when you've got a country like Pakistan, which at this point thought that its very national survival depended on the bomb, depended on getting the nuclear bomb. It's very hard to stop a country like that, to be honest, very hard. Because if they say it as a matter of national survival, precisely because their neighbour India, they believe, is developing its own bomb, then, frankly, they'll be willing to do a lot in order to get it.
One of the questions that that always comes up about a QCon, it goes to the issue of motivation. Mm-hmm. That is why he did what he did. And particularly when we get to the point of the allegations about providing the know-how, the technology to countries like Iran, mm-hmm. Libya, and North Korea. But perhaps even you can back up and ask that question at the point where he made the offer, where he knew that he had access to important information, and that he mm-hmm. then said to his government, I can help our country become a nuclear power. What his motivation was, and at that time, was it, do you think mostly it was patriotism, or even then, was it some sort of blending of patriotism and self-interest?
I think it was, he was first and foremost a patriot in terms of wanting to protect his country. He was, as I said, Pakistan had been defeated in 1971, which affected, I think, Ayub Khan personally quite a lot, and that sense of injured pride and that desire to prevent it ever happening again was very strong. So I think there was this element of nationalism, of patriotism. I think there was also a strong element of ego. I think he had a very, very strong ego, which grew hugely over time. And he clearly saw himself as a kind of self-proclaimed savior of his country to some extent, and as someone who could deliver it from its problems. And I think that issue of his ego grew and grew and was fueled by the kind of adoration and the support given by the Pakistani state, and also the secrecy of his work that he undertook.
And it's my understanding that even after the revolution, the revelations that we have talked about, that is, he traded this technology for profit to these mm-hmm. other countries, even after those revelations came out, it's my understanding that within Pakistan, he is still, generally speaking, highly thought of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, he's more popular than the president. I think that's a fair statement, which is always one of the problems, that he was always more popular than many of the political leaders of the country, and he still is, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, still in Parliament, they debate about why he should be under house arrest and why he shouldn't be freed and how unfair this is. He is still a popular leader, a popular figure, and the reason is simple, is because he is seen, and he helped create this idea but through his own efforts, but he is seen as the man who delivered the bomb, the nuclear bomb, to his country, and therefore gave his country security. And that, to many people in Pakistan, is far more important than the other things he did.
Our guest is Gordon Carrera. He is a security correspondent for BBC News. He covers counterterrorism, nuclear proliferation, international security issues for both television, radio, and online. His book, recently published about this story that we're discussing here, is titled Shopping for Bombs, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. And we have a caller to bring into the conversation, and of course, people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi, yes. How are you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to thank you for all your research and your reporting, because this is an extremely important issue, and it's not addressed very much. I mean, it's sort of in a cursory sense. You'll see it in the third or fourth page of the New York Times. But the proliferation of this stuff and the way it's gotten around, and you were right about the centrifuges and the way in which these people got around all these supposed embargoes. But it's interesting to note that back in the Clinton administration, somehow the U.S. government found out that one of the U.S. manufacturers was selling miniaturization technology or giving it, whatever, to the Chinese, and all of a sudden they could develop smaller warheads for their missiles. And do you know anything about whatever happened with that in the United States?
Well, I don't know too much about that specific miniaturization issue. I do know that it's interesting because one of the issues that comes up when you look at Ayub Khan is the amount of support that China gave to Pakistan, actually. Mm-hmm. And in fact, China was very important in giving its thought a warhead design to Pakistan. Yeah. And a very early design that it tested in the 60s, which it gave to Pakistan and to Ayub Khan specifically, in which the Ayub Khan then passed on to others. And China was a really important supporter of Pakistan. I mean, in the 90s, there was a big debate within Washington about how hard to clamp down on China's activities, because China then, for instance, was was looking at selling missiles to Pakistan. It had also sold some ring magnets, which are used in centrifuges, to Pakistan for use in Pakistan's nuclear program. And there was quite a bit of debate about how tough to be. And some critical voices felt that that the administration during the 90s wasn't tough enough on China. It prioritized improving relations, trade, and so on, rather than being tough on proliferation. So China's quite an interesting player in all this, because its role over time in the spread of nuclear technology has been quite mixed. And at times it's been helpful, at times it's been much less helpful. But even recently, it's still kind of quite clear that the Chinese are still after nuclear secrets and have possibly been helping other countries as well to some extent. Nothing like AQ Khan, the scale of help, but their relationship, at least of some of individuals in China and AQ Khan, is definitely unclear, at least.
Yeah, but also I wanted to say that because they sort of quit testing in the West, you know, they don't do atmospheric testing and stuff that in the 60s, do you think sort of people have sort of become like inured to the fact of what these things can actually do? I mean, the power of these weapons, I mean, even an atomic, just, you know, not a hydrogen bomb, could, you know, kill, I mean, 20 million people if given the right I mean, it's almost as if, like, everybody acts like they're toys. They use as political tools, and everybody goes, oh, who cares if Khan sold all this technology and bought this technology from the West? And you're exactly right. It is a highly sophisticated technology, and it's basically was, you know, just taken apart and resold in pieces to these countries, and it really very upsetting, but no one seems to care. I thank you. I really want to thank you for your reporting. You're very interesting person. Thank you.
Well, no, thank you very much. And I think you're right that I think we need to be worried about this. I mean, you know, and the fact is some people think, well, they'll never be used. You know, they were used once, you know, 60 years ago, but they're not going to be used. But I think that's wrong. I mean, I think, you know, India and Pakistan have come close to using them. You know, in the last 5-6 years, there was a crisis, you know, in after the Indian Parliament was attacked. Two countries are thought to have come pretty close in 2002 to actually using them. So, you know, the devastation would have been, you know, unimaginable if they had. And as I said, they came close. So this isn't something abstract, I think, this idea of the spread of nuclear weapons. It could be very real, and we should be awake to that. So, yeah, thanks for your comment.
Yeah, well, let's continue. We have another caller. This is someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that there's a lot of history here. You said it's murky, but Zia al-Haq was the U.S.'s favorite dictator for part of the period for geopolitical reasons. And it was actually the Saudis had much more to do with bankrolling the...
That's right.
I mean, you can have all the information you want, but if you don't have the money to buy the sophisticated technology, you're nowhere. And Pakistan was not a high candidate for proliferation without outside aid. And the U.S. was, you know, working on all sorts of things through the 80s. With Saudis, we had, you know, that's our another special relationship, as we call it, maybe more special than the one with England these days.
Yeah, two really interesting points you made there. Firstly, you're right about bankrolling. A lot of countries bankrolled Pakistan in the 70s. Pakistan went looking for the money. Prime Minister Bhutto went on a tour of Gulf states looking for money, and a lot of these countries, quite smartly from their point of view, thought, well, if we build a bomb, then Israel may attack us because, you know, of our proximity. It may be seen as anti-Israel, whereas if Pakistan builds it, they may be able to get away with it because it'll be seen as a counter to India's bomb, and people will tolerate it, which is to some extent what happened. But the technology will still be there and will have been developed by a Muslim country. So that argument was quite successful in getting funding, including from Saudi Arabia. The other thing you mentioned was that in the 80s, America's relationship with President Zia ul-Haq is very important, because this was really the point at which maybe some pressure could have been put on Pakistan over its nuclear program, and Khan's networks could have been stopped before they got to selling things. But the problem was Pakistan had become an indispensable ally to the United States in fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan after the invasion in December 79. And so Pakistan's help was vital, because it was through Pakistan that the money was funneled to the Mujahideen to support that. And that was seen as far more important than stopping Pakistan's nuclear program. And there was a clear decision made about which was the priority. And as a result, Pakistan was allowed, and AQ Khan was allowed, to get on with its nuclear program.
It's another dimension of blowback from the project in Afghanistan. Mm,
absolutely. That's definitely true.
And China is aiding Pakistan because of the India-China animosities.
Absolutely. That's right. Yeah.
Regional. So, and now with this tilt towards India, where we're actually pretty much tearing up the NPT treaty by going allowing aid to go in to India whilst they're not signatories, it actually is undermining the Pakistan-India kind of hit and miss efforts towards some kind of détente, it seems to me, and that's just more gasoline on the fire. And I think the U.S. role is important here. It's expedient to let Zia al-Haq do what he has to do. He thinks when he's necessary to us, but now we can condemn Pakistan and the scientist involved, who's really pretty incidental, it seems, to the grand scheme of things.
Well,
so I don't know whether you'll agree with that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you.
Well, I think that you and the caller both make an important point here, and that is how the role the United States played in here, as you said, going back to the period in the first Afghan war, when the Russians were there and we were funneling assistance to the Afghan guerrillas who were fighting the Russians, that Pakistan was very important because it was going through Pakistan. Then it seemed like there was a little point where once the Russians were out of Afghanistan, it's almost as if we decided we didn't care much about Pakistan anymore. And then, of course, at 9/11, Pakistan became very important again because we needed Pakistan's cooperation in going after the Taliban and going after al-Qaeda. So once again there, we're in a position where we really had to be careful about how heavily we leaned on the Musharraf government because we wanted to have Pakistan's continued cooperation in dealing with what we thought were our concerns with terrorism. So it seems that all along, either because we didn't want to alienate the Pakistanis, or there was a point where we didn't much care, and then again we didn't want to alienate the Pakistanis, it got in the way of our being able to do something perhaps more serious to deal with the proliferation problem by getting at specifically what Khan and what Pakistan was doing.
Absolutely. I think U.S.-Pakistan relations are kind of central theme of the book. I think what you see there is just it's a kind of very on-off relationship. There's not much subtlety or even keel to it. It's during the 70s it's off, then suddenly in the 80s they're back on very close. And then suddenly when the Afghan war is over, the U.S. effectively abandons Pakistan and cuts it loose, which really angered a lot of Pakistanis. Now, you could argue, well, it's their fault for developing the bomb and doing all these other things, and they deserved that to happen. But they felt, well, having been close allies in the 80s fighting the Mujahideen, we were cut off. Then through the 90s, relations are pretty bad. Then suddenly, 9/11, they're back on again with this close relationship. And once again, very similar to the 80s, you have this problem that nuclear proliferation takes second place, and at least initially, to dealing with other issues. Al-Qaeda, I mean, obvious in a way, after 9/11, that Al-Qaeda will be the priority. But again, you have competing priorities. But what you see now, it's very interesting, is yes, there's a close U.S.-Pakistan relationship, but the Pakistanis are constantly thinking that the U.S. will once again turn their back on them when the U.S. doesn't need them anymore. And as a result, the relationship is much more complex now. It is a very, very complicated, difficult relationship, I think, between the U.S. and Pakistan. And that's one of the important themes to the book, is how that fitted in with AQ Khan's story and the attempts to stop him.
Well, this is, in a sense, a side issue, but is the government of Pakistan concerned? Do they worry that the United States is becoming too close to India? And that in that relationship that there has been this tilt towards India, does that worry
Absolutely.
The Pakistanis?
Yeah, I mean, it does. And they have always worried that India is the bigger country, clearly. It is the far more significant economy. Strategically, also, in dealing with China, India is more useful or important. So the Pakistanis have always been worried that they will be, if you like, abandoned, and there will be a tilt towards India. And this U.S.-India nuclear deal has got a lot of concern in Pakistan, as you'd expect, the fact that the U.S. is is talking about cooperation, and the Pakistanis are saying, well, why can't we get the same deal? And it's very interesting. When they ask that of U.S. officials, why can't we get a nuclear cooperation deal? The answer is because of AQ Khan. You know, we don't believe that you can be trusted with this kind of nuclear cooperation precisely because of the kind of thing that AQ Khan got up to.
We have another caller, someone listening in Chicago. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. My name is Mohammed, and calling from Chicago. I'm from Pakistan. And the concern I have, the U.S. relation with military in Pakistan, because every time the military comes up, U.S. relation goes very good. Any civilian hukumat, any civilian government, the relation goes bad. And that's what happened in 70s, in 60s, in 80s, and now, right now. So the main problem is policies. Thank you.
I
think that's a really interesting point, because one of the arguments is that the U.S. has always looked to what it can get out of Pakistan, but it's not necessarily looked towards building long-term democratic institutions there, not look to building civil society, not look to helping a diversity of political parties developed. It's always been focused on, if you like, big strategic interests, short-term interests, military interests, but not necessarily democratic development. And as a result, Pakistan has suffered, and it has lived for so many periods under military rule.
Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Others would like to call. Your questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Gordon Carrera. He is security correspondent for BBC News and has authored a book about AQ Khan. His book is titled Shopping for Bombs, Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQ Khan Network. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We talked about Khan's involvement in the Pakistani nuclear program. Let's talk about this next big piece of the story, which is his providing that, selling that kind of technology, that kind of know-how to several other countries, including Iran, North Korea, and Libya. And apparently the first place this happened was with Iran. How did that happen? How is it that he took that leap from developing his own country's program to then using the kind of network that he had set up to be able to do that, to then provide that technology to another country?
Well, it's very interesting because you use the word network, and actually the network is very important, the network of businessmen. And the network of businessmen like Khan himself had realized there was a lot of money to be made out of the clandestine nuclear business. They had something incredibly valuable. They had something which no one else had, you know, at least in the open marketplace, and which lots of countries would desperately want if they did want to develop their own nuclear program. So they knew this. The businessmen wanted to make money. Khan wanted to make money, but also had other interests as well, strategic interests in some of his deals. And so they began to get in touch, and also other countries realized what Khan was doing and so got in touch with him. And so the first deal we do know of is in 1987, it takes place in a hotel room in Dubai, where some Iranian representatives meet members of AQ Khan's business network, and they pay for the centrifuge designs. They don't get machines at this point. They get the designs, and then the Iranians use those as the basis for their nuclear program. And it's incredibly important for the Iranian program. I mean, to give you some idea how important it is, when the Iranian program was finally revealed to the world in 2002, a few months later, inspectors from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, went into Iran. They went into the plant in Natanz in, I think, February 2003, and they looked at the Iranian machines that the Iranians were building. And one of them said, just by sight, that he knew exactly where they came from, because this inspector had worked at Urenco in the 70s with Khan and knew that it was exactly the same kind of machine from Urenco, and immediately realized that what had happened was Khan had used his Urenco designs and passed them on to Iran. And so Khan's help to Iran is absolutely invaluable in getting the Iranian program moving.
He also apparently offered this same kind of technology to Iraq, and the Iraqis were suspicious. They didn't take him up on the offer because they thought this was a trick.
Exactly. It's interesting. He offered it to Iraq, to the Iraqis, and the Iraqis sat there and looked at it and thought, what do we do about this? To some extent, they wanted to do it themselves rather than get help. But also, it does appear that they thought it was actually a sting operation by the CIA or others, and that it was a trick, and countries were trying to trick them. They didn't believe it. This was in 1990, actually. But it is also, of course, interesting if you think about it. Iran and Iraq, during the 80s, around this time, were deadly enemies. And Khan and his network were willing to sell to both sides.
He also was involved in trading secrets to North Korea. Mm. Now, here, it seems that at least in part, there was an interest in a reciprocal gain of technology for Pakistan, because here at this time they were interested in missile technology. You can have a bomb, but you also have to have some way to deliver it. The North Koreans had it. Now, was this something that started out as an attempt to get something for Pakistan, to get that technology for Pakistan, and so the way to do it was to trade the bomb technology for the missile technology with the North Koreans?
Well, that's what everyone thinks. It's a very murky deal, because what happened is in about 1993, end of 93, Pakistan's prime minister goes over to North Korea. It's known the Pakistanis are desperate to get hold of North Korean missiles, and a deal is done there to get hold of the North Korean missiles. But one of the problems is Pakistan doesn't have any money to pay for these. It's a very poor country. And it's known that the North Koreans want centrifuge enrichment technology, nuclear technology. And so by about the mid-90s, there's clearly a barter going on, a deal in which the Pakistanis are getting North Korean Nodong missiles, and the North Koreans are getting centrifuge machines from AQ Khan, and they get a number of them for their program. So in that case, it's not necessarily a money deal by the network, by the businessmen, but looks much more like a strategic deal, a barter.
The biggest deal that he did was with Libya.
Right.
And the thing that makes this different, perhaps, than the others, is that in other cases, what those countries wanted was maybe what they wanted was technical information, and then maybe they wanted also bits of technology that they could put together to then build the centrifuges and produce the fuel. And the Libyans, they wanted everything. They wanted a nuclear program in a box, essentially.
Absolutely. I mean, they wanted centrifuge machines. They wanted machines to build centrifuge machines. They wanted absolutely everything from start to finish to be provided by AQ Khan's business network. It really was a completely different scale than just wanting some technical help, assistance, or designs. They wanted the works, a full turnkey program. Estimated $100 million, $150 million, that's something around the money that we're talking about for this. This leads to an expansion of AQ Khan's network, because all of a sudden they're having to manufacture all these different parts and get hold of them. And so they set up production hubs around the world, one in South Africa, one in Malaysia. Material comes from Turkey, all of it routed through Dubai to then go to Libya. And it becomes a huge global network.
Hmm. And this, of course, ultimately was his undoing when the Libyans, much to the surprise of a lot of people, first of all said that they had a program to produce nuclear weapons, and then said, and we have made the decision that we're going to close down the program and abandon this effort as part of their trying to establish a much more positive relationship with the rest of the world. This was something that Britain was very much involved in negotiating quietly for a very long period of time. I think that's why suddenly it came to a lot of people as a big surprise. But that was his undoing. And for those people who were trying to find some way to stop him, that the Libyans, their decision to give up their program, that for them, for the effort to stop Khan, this was the big break.
Absolutely. I mean, the growth of the network to supply Libya set off warning bells in London, Washington, elsewhere, and they began to monitor it and realize something was going on. But stopping it was another matter, partly because of proving it, partly because how do you put pressure on Pakistan to do something about it? But the real key moment came in March 2003 when Colonel Gaddafi, through an intermediary, approached Britain's MI6, its intelligence agency, and said, we want to talk about our nuclear program. And there then followed a long, very tortuous, very difficult set of negotiations and back and forth between the countries, with the US also involved heavily, to try and see if the Libyans were serious about coming clean and what they were willing to give up. Eventually, in December 2003, Colonel Gaddafi announced he was giving up this program, and it was clear that almost all of the program had come from AQ Khan. So all of a sudden, here was AQ Khan's role exposed to the world, and here, very importantly, was a lot of evidence about it, the actual machines, the materials, the names of the company who'd supplied it, the warhead design with writing on it, which made it clear it had come from Pakistan. All that information suddenly was there out in the open, and suddenly they had enough material, finally, to put the pressure on President Musharraf to actually do something about AQ Khan and stop him and put him out of business.
But again, just to sort of underline the point that we made, at this point here we're talking about, this is 2003?
Yeah, that's right, end of 2003.
For how long had the intelligence services of Britain and the United States and anybody else really known what AQ Khan was doing?
That's a really good question. The answer is slightly complicated because they actually knew what AQ Khan was doing in terms of building Pakistan's own bomb as early as the mid-1970s. Not long after he fled from Europe back to Pakistan, they started to realize that he was building the bomb. However, they didn't realize he was selling the technology to other countries like Libya, Iran, North Korea, until the late 1990s. It was only then that they realized that he was doing something much more than building Pakistan's own bomb. And then, so there was a failure, if you like, to appreciate what he was up to and that he'd started selling the technology. That was, to a large extent, missed, particularly through the 1990s. And then there was a very successful intelligence operation starting from the late 90s to penetrate AQ Khan's network and to understand it and eventually to bring it down. Mm.
And it's at this point then the government of Pakistan has to do something. They can't turn a blind eye to this anymore. They can't pretend this is not
going on.
And then at this point then Khan himself publicly admits, yes, he said, yes, I did it. I sold this technology to these other countries. Almost immediately, President Musharraf, General Musharraf, pardons him. And as we said, he's under house arrest. He's at his house. No one has any access to him. Agencies who would like to be able to talk with him can't. And then I suppose the thinking is that, as far as the Pakistanis are concerned, that AQ Khan knows stuff that they don't
Absolutely.
Want anybody to know. So they don't want him talking to anybody about what he did and about what other people in the government of Pakistan might have done and about who knew all about all of this. They just want to keep the lid on that as much as they can.
Absolutely. I mean, it comes back firstly to this problem about how popular he is, that's always been a problem in dealing with him and getting the Pakistani government to deal with him. But also, as you said, the big question is how much did the Pakistani government know about what he was doing? How much did some individuals, not necessarily the whole government, but how much did some individuals in the military authorize or let him do it or know and let him get away with it? Some potentially very embarrassing information there about Pakistan's role, which they don't want to come out. And so for that reason, the solution they came up with was we'll have him confess, we'll put him under house arrest, but we won't hand him over to anyone. And that was the way they left it with him, and that's the way it is still today. He's still there under house arrest in a house in Islamabad, which I drove past, but I couldn't get into.
Mm. Did anyone else who was involved with AQ Khan, anybody who was part of this network, has anyone else been charged with any crimes?
Well, I think that's one of the frustrating things. I mean, one of the interesting things about AQ Khan's network is that, you know, we talked a lot about Pakistan, but actually most of the businessmen, the key businessmen, were European. A lot of them were. And not all of them have been charged. There's a few due to go on trial, including in some who were based in South Africa who are alleged to have been involved, some in Germany. But it's proved a very difficult and very slow process to bring people to trial. Another one of his key lieutenants is in Malaysia, but under house arrest, hasn't been put on trial. It's been very hard for the authorities to actually to charge them, to find the right evidence and to bring it to trial. And that's, I think, quite worrying for a lot of people because people say, well, you know, what's what's the disincentive for people getting involved in this business? If you're a businessman, you can make millions of dollars, but the chances are you won't end up being convicted. Well, you know, people might be tempted. And so there's a lot of concern that the laws dealing with this kind of activity aren't strong enough, aren't good enough at bringing people to trial.
Khan himself, as we have said and as you have said, certainly initially as the so-called father of the Pakistani bomb, became a highly honored, highly respected person in his country for that, and still, even with the what we've talked about, his selling secrets to other countries, still people honor him and respect him for that, for shepherding Pakistan's effort to build the bomb. Did he, in addition to becoming an important, revered figure in Pakistan, did he, as a result of particularly the sales of technology, of information technology to other countries, did he profit from this? Did he become a wealthy man because of it?
Yeah, he became a very wealthy man, and he had properties all over the world. I mean, he wasn't necessarily an extravagant man, but he was no doubt he was wealthy. And one of the interesting questions is, you know, was it money? Was it money that motivated him? I think it was one of the motivating forces, but I don't think it was the only one. You know, I really don't think it's enough. I think his ego, his belief he could get away with it was important. But I also think there was a kind of ideology behind him, and his ideology was really a resentment against the West and against the nuclear non-proliferation system. He basically resented the idea that certain countries could have the bomb and tell other countries around the world that they couldn't have it. He hated that idea because he hated the fact that so many countries had tried to stop Pakistan developing its own bomb. So in his mind, spreading that technology, spreading the knowledge, would undermine the non-proliferation system and damage it, which was something he sought to do. So I think money is one explanation for what he did, but not necessarily the only one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can understand, given the tense relationship between India and Pakistan, and at the point where the Indians demonstrated their capacity to build the weapons, you could understand the Pakistanis deciding for their own security that they needed to do that too. So for him, it's understandable. You could see the motive of patriotism there, that he was interested in the country's, in his country's security and its defense. And for that reason, it would be important to say, if the Indians have the bomb, we need to have the bomb. It's another step entirely from going that to saying something like, well, then in that case, maybe anybody who wants the bomb should be able to have the bomb. I mean, that seems to be a leap and you're dropping your scruples somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
In between saying our security is important, but then, okay, if you pay me enough, I'll sell it to anybody.
Absolutely. And I think I wouldn't want to necessarily say he was scrupulous is the wrong word. I just think he and a lot of the business around him tried to justify what they were doing. And I think they developed a kind of justification in their own minds that actually the bomb, for instance, they would say when you ask them, the bomb isn't dangerous because people won't use it. And the more countries that have it, the deterrence works, so it won't actually ever be used. Why can't other countries have it, therefore? So, you know, there was a kind of strange thinking to what they did. But yes, I mean, to some extent, that just cloaked greed and ego as well.
Yeah. When you look at the story and you look at how apparently inadequate the controls that we have on the knowledge and the technology are that made it possible for him to take that knowledge, bring it back to Pakistan, and then also to get access to the technology, not the whole technology, but the pieces enough so that then you could go ahead and you could build it yourself, provided, as an earlier caller said, provided you had the money, which of course is not a small consideration. But that all that makes you think that if he could do it, somebody else could do it, and maybe somebody else has or is trying to do this. You have to wonder, is A.Q. Khan somehow an aberration, a fluke, or should we be worried that there are, even today around the world, other A.Q. Khans?
Well, I think in some ways A.Q. Khan was unique, because he was this unique figure who had access to these secrets in Europe, who had the protection of the Pakistani state in what he was doing, and so was able to get away with it. But I think you're right in saying that couldn't other people come along and do that? And I think one of the fears is that the more nuclear programs there are out there, the more secret nuclear programs there are out there, there, the more likely it is that someone else will try and do that. We'll see Khan as a role model and as a way to successfully do what Khan did. And I can imagine that happening again. There's no evidence at the moment that anyone is quite as dangerous as Khan is, but you could imagine someone in another country's nuclear program who thought the same way and decided to go about the same thing. So I think one of the problems as well is the legacy of AQ Khan, because actually a lot of this material that he stole, these secret centrifuge designs, nuclear warhead designs, once it's out of the secrecy, it's out there, and no one knows, for instance, how many copies AQ Khan made of the centrifuge design. By the end, he was putting them onto CDs. They were burning them on CDs in Dubai. Did he make copies of the nuclear warhead design he got hold of? You know, one of the things that people really are worried about is that actually this material, this technology, this very secret, or once very secret know-how, could now still be out there, and therefore it would be much easier for someone else to come along and be a new AQ Khan, because they could just piggyback and use the work and the technology he'd stolen and he'd worked on.
Yeah, and the idea that the Pakistani government would ever let American intelligence, British intelligence, the IAEA, anybody like that anywhere near this guy ever, is that just, you say it's just not going to happen?
Well, I tell you, there is no way that they could publicly allow it to happen. I've always, you know, wondered whether maybe secretly some kind of deal could be done, but there's no way publicly they could allow it to happen, because the uproar in Pakistan would be enormous. I mean, as I said, you know, he is still more popular, arguably, there's no real opinion polling on it, but just instinctively, than a lot of the political leaders, including probably the president. So to be seen to hand him over or let him be interrogated would cause a political crisis in Pakistan. So it seems very unlikely.
Well, there we will have to leave it. It's a remarkable story, a good piece of reporting. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time today to talk about it.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest, Gordon Carrera, he is security correspondent for the BBC, covering counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and international security issues for both BBC television, radio, and online. The book, if you would like to read it, is Shopping for Bombs: Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQ Khan Network, and it's published by the Oxford University Press.